You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
The Prime Minister's talked to Moscow. They're saying it was an accident during a routine training exercise.
Governments change. The lies stay the same.
What else do we know about the Yanis Syndicate?
Top flight arms dealers headquartered in St. Petersburg. First outfit to restock the Iraqis during the Gulf War. The headman's unreliably described, no photographs. The woman, Onatopp, is our only confirmed contact.
Would you care for a drink?
Thank you. Your predecessor kept some cognac in the top.
I prefer bourbon. Ice?
Yes.
We've pulled the files on anyone who might have had access or authority at Seven Eye. The top name on the list's an old friend of yours, I understand.
Oromov. They made him a general.
He sees himself as the next Iron Man of Russia, which is why our political analysts rule him out. He doesn't fit the profile of a traitor.
Are these the same analysts who said the GoldenEye couldn't exist? Who said the helicopter posed no immediate threat and wasn't worth following?
You don't like me, Bond. You don't like my methods. You think I'm an accountant. A bean counter, more interested in my numbers and your instincts.
The thought had occurred to me.
Good. Because I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur. A relic of the Cold War. Whose boyish charms, though wasted on me, obviously appeal to that young woman I sent out to evaluate you.
Point taken.
Not quite, 007. If you think for one moment I don't have the balls to send a man out to die, your instincts are dead wrong. I've no compunction about sending you to your death. But I won't do it on a whim, even with your cavalier attitude towards life. I want you to find GoldenEye, find who took it, what they plan to do with it, and stop it. And if you should come across Oromov, guilty or not, I don't want you running off on some kind of vendetta. Avenging Alec Trevelyan will not bring him back.
You didn't get him killed.
Neither did you. Don't make it personal.
Never.
Bond, come back alive.
Welcome back to the 602 Club, coming at you from MI6. We can't tell you which room because, well, then we'd have to kill you, but we're so excited to be back. It's been a long hiatus, a six-year hiatus from our last film with Timothy Dalton and License to Kill, but we're back. And we have a brand new Bond to talk about, which always makes me excited. My very first Bond movie in the theater. So lets you know a little bit how old I am. You know, though, if we're going to do Bond, we have to have some incredible guests. And I am so pleased to have back as we start the last era of Bond that we need to cover here on the 602 Club, Christy Morris.
Hey, I am back and I have a license to kill, but not to break the traffic laws.
Well, that's good. That's good. You know, I mean, which is strange because, you know, by breaking traffic laws, you could use your license to kill, right?
Right. So that gets really circular in logic. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I don't know. I think Q is mistaken there. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I absolutely have to agree. And by the way, I think we should have maybe taken 6 years off just to make the audience feel the same anticipation that I felt in 1995. Waiting between License to Kill and GoldenEye.
You had enough already.
Yeah, just so you could walk in my shoes and know what it felt like. Oh, when are we going to get the next Bond movie? But here we are, just after a couple of months, bringing you GoldenEye. the
Yeah, you didn't even have to wait that long. So no. Feel lucky, 602 Club listeners.
Yeah.
Well, we're super excited to be with you tonight to talk about this, and really got a couple things to say. Obviously, you can find us all over the place. You can find us on iTunes at itunes.com/trekfm, where we have all of our podcasts. But while you're over there, hit us up with a star rating review. You know, we say it every time, but it totally makes a difference when you give us those star ratings and reviews. And I love calling out people on the show and thanking them for their views. And honestly, it's been a while since I've been able to do that. So I would love to be able to do that soon. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, where you should be following us and liking us. You can also find us on Twitter at trekfm, where you should be following us for sure, so you can get all of the details of everything that's happening here on Trek FM. You can also find us on our listeners-only discussion group. Now, that is also on Facebook. It's called the Babel Conference, and if you're on Facebook, you can type Babel into the search field there, or if you go to our website at trek.fm, you can click discussion on any of the menu bars, and that will bring you over there and allow you to talk with all of the other listeners who are conversing about all the different shows and all the different topics that are going on over there. It's a lot of fun. And then last but not least, make sure you do check out Trek.fm. While you're over there, if you want to shoot us an email, you can do that. Go to Trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that email will come to me and then any of the hosts that were on that week, and we'll be able to talk to you with whatever it is that you had on your mind. So, John, you totally already spoiled it, but we're going to be continuing Bond, as we always do. But it was 6 years in a hiatus. And for myself, as I mentioned earlier, this was the first time that I saw Bond in the theater, but it was also the time when I started really kind of paying attention to what was going on behind the scenes with things. And so it was a big deal that this was coming out. But I wanted to ask you specifically, because Christy, you're a youngling on the podcast, mm-hmm. and I think you said you were 6 when this came out?
8.
Okay. And so, John, what was it like for you wading through the 6 years of legal disputes that caused Timothy Dalton to drop out and for them finally to hire Pierce Brosnan? I can't even imagine being a Bond fan and just being like, what the heck is going on?
It's really hard to overstate the anticipation around this movie. It truly is. I mean, we kind of know today, we all get excited about a new Star Wars movie, and we all know we're going to be there opening night. We all know we're going to be excited about a new Marvel movie. We all know we're going to be there opening night. But to wait 6 years and for the announcement of a new Bond to be this sort of like cultural touchstone, it is a massively big deal. It was a big deal when Roger Moore took over. It was a big deal when Timothy Dalton took over. But this was something really special because Pierce Brosnan had been offered the role before and couldn't do it. And American TV audiences knew and loved Pierce Brosnan as Remington Steele. And I can only imagine that it was a similar thing to British TV audiences who knew Roger Moore from The Saint. Now, I didn't. I know that Roger Moore was on The Saint, and I have watched The Saint since knowing him as Bond. But to an audience in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, who knew Roger Moore in that role, it must have been a really big deal to see this guy announced as their next James Bond. For an American pop culture consumer, as I was in 1995 and the years before and the years since, this was just like, it was like water in the desert. You know, we finally got something. And you could tell right from the beginning that Michael G. Wilson, the Eon Productions, everybody behind this, Martin Campbell, that they were all planning for this to wow the audience. They knew that this was high stakes. They knew that it had to be good. Yeah, I'm trying to pick my words carefully here because I said you can't overstate it. You can't overstate it. It was absolutely filled with anticipation to see this new Bond, to see a Bond for the 90s. And I don't want to give short shrift to Timothy Dalton, because the three of us sat here and absolutely praised his portrayal of Bond in his two movies, even if the movies were a bit imperfect. But this was something very, very special in 95 when we anticipated the release of GoldenEye.
I have to agree with you there. And even though I will chime in and say, of course, like you said, Matt, I'm the youngling here. I didn't have the same experience at the same time as you, of course, because I was too young. But that's a long time. And you had to think at some point, is there going to be another Bond? I mean, Is this going to just end and we're not going to get another Bond movie? So I can't imagine how upsetting that would feel. I mean, it probably the same as how Star Wars fans felt after, you know, Return of the Jedi.
Right.
Not knowing. So I think that it's really exciting in that sense that, like you said, like water in the desert, you finally get this payoff, and that it's somebody that has kind of been encircling the Bond world before, because who did we figure out he was married to that was around previously? Is it a Bond girl?
Brosnan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I might have the name wrong. Cassandra Harris, she was in Free Eyes Only. She was the countess that sort of had a hidden past that was revealed to Bond.
Right, because I think we were saying he was on set while they were filming this, and it was weird because he was married to her and he was not Bond.
Yes.
It's really interesting because kind of coming into this, you know, this was my first kind of foray into Bond in this way. And, you know, the thing about Bond at that point too, you know, it would be on like ABC television, you know, the Saturday night movie, you know, they would have the Bonds on and those kind of things. So you'd see them then. And so, you know, I knew who Bond was and everything, but this was a big deal. And then of course, you know, on the whole other side of it, the game itself became its own thing.
Yeah.
The Nintendo 64 game, mm-hmm. which was just, I mean, that's one of the best games that I'd ever played at that point, you know, and like, so that had a whole life of its own as well. So there's all this stuff that's happening. And I think it is interesting to me, though, that Timothy Dalton does resign from the role because of this amount of time that's been left. And I wanted to ask you guys, did you think at all as you were watching this, what if Dalton had continued on?
I thought that over and over while watching this movie, to be quite honest with you. And here's the thing, like, I don't want to, oh man, this is tricky territory. I don't want to spoil my feelings about GoldenEye. Because I'll be honest with you, I had some mixed feelings about GoldenEye after watching this again after maybe a 10-year gap. You know, I was there the week this movie opened in 1995. I was so full of anticipation for this. And I watched it many times after that. And then the last time I watched it was probably 10 years ago. And I'll get into the feelings that I had about this for our rewatch today. But I so kept thinking that Timothy Dalton had been robbed, because his movies were okay, but the problems with his movies were not Timothy Dalton. Mm-hmm. The problems with the movies were things like budget and pacing and style and just sort of being lost in the wilderness creatively with what they were doing with Bond. Here you had this really strong actor with a really strong grasp on the role thrown into, I think, this sort of transitional period for Bond where they just didn't quite know what to do with him. And I felt like License to Kill in particular was kind of a step down instead of what should have been a step up for an actor in his second Bond movie. It was sort of a step down just in terms of overall production value, even though he is still absolutely awesome in the role. I watched GoldenEye and I thought, this is the movie that Timothy Dalton deserved, because he needed the opportunity to grow more into the role and have a movie that really suited him and really elevated him as Bond.
And see, I'm 50-50. I'm 50% right there with you, and then 50% going, I like the personality of Dalton in that he can be that really serious Bond. That was especially a big difference from Moore. Mm-hmm. But I think that Brosnan can play it a little bit softer while still being able to turn stern when he needs to. And that I liked that difference in this movie. So, like I said, I kind of feel like either one of them could have done it justice because the story was there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you're saying, that all of the other things like budget and the story and the ability to tell a better overall plot was there, and instead of having something that was kind of a step down.
Yeah.
Thinking it through, the thing is, I could totally see Timothy Dalton being in this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing about this movie that makes it feel like a Brosnan movie as apart from a Timothy Dalton movie, especially with what we saw Timothy Dalton could do with the role. And so, and I agree with you, John, I do feel like that this is actually the story that is very strong. You know, it finally would have been that movie that would have, I think, catapulted Timothy Dalton to being one of the people would be questioning then, is he the best Bond ever?
Right.
You know? And so, it's interesting, too, because the struggle for them was this question of, you know, which they, you know, you keep having to have now that we're out of the Cold War. Is Bond relevant? And that question actually created something that was really, I think, key to making this a great Bond film in the sense of the storyline that we get, because the world has completely changed now. So as we're continuing Bond, the world that Bond inhabits is very different. And I feel like one of the things that we struggled with the Dalton era films is that we're in that middle period where the Soviet Union, I mean, I don't want to be mean, but really isn't that much of a threat anymore. And so the villains and stuff, they just don't seem as, I don't know, villainous. You know, that it's just not what you really want. And this created out of the chaos of the world of the 90s and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Russian mafia and the beginning of cybercrime, all of those things. I mean, this movie is like on the cutting edge of all that stuff. Like Bond is back at being on the cutting edge of stories instead of being at the tail end. And so, you know, you think of all of that together and yeah, you're absolutely right. Dalton could have done great in the role, but I'm with you, Christy, in that there's something about Brosnan in this role. It's like he was born to be Bond, you know? Like, and so him finally getting to be Bond, you know, I thought was interesting. So I wanted to dive in specifically about him with you guys and talk through Brosnan finally being this character and what we think of his portrayal of the character.
Sure. So I will add, first of all, for everybody out there, man, he is sexy. I mean,
no argument here.
Pierce yeah. Brosnan has yeah, it know. All.
Yeah.
He's got, you know, like I said, that he can be soft and caring and then suddenly be funny and sarcastic. But he's, you know, it's sort of that scene where he's with his therapist in the car and she's supposed to be evaluating him and he's saying she goes, you know, I love this just as much as the next girl, but, and then she said something like, who's that girl? Oh, the next girl the one who clearly is better than you. But he can also suddenly turn to aggressive or stern whenever he needs to. I think that he really is very versatile of an actor, and that this role was made for him. And then he just, combined with that, gets a really great storyline to fill into. And I think that he just handles this with a lot of strength, I think, is the biggest thing I see with Brosnan. Not so serious, though, like I said, with Dalton. I feel like Dalton, to me, was a little bit more realistic. He seemed to remind me more of, you know, Bond having been married before. You know, these things that usually you don't think are going to be a thing in Bond's life. You know, I think that probably for most guys, Bond is the guy they all want to be. So you like to think of all the positive things and not the sad things. And I like that Brosnan also has this reveal with thinking 006 is like a dear friend and a coworker that, you know, you can share all your secrets with. And then he turns on him. So I think that Brosnan played that scene better than Dalton would have been able to convey that stunned expression.
Yeah, so here we go, Christy. Now I'll meet you halfway. I'll echo 50% of what you're saying, which is Pierce Brosnan was born for this role, and he is a sexy slice of man, and he looks great in the role. He can wear the clothes. He can do the action. I loved watching the behind-the-scenes stuff on this, seeing how much he did on his own. And he looks like he's having a great time, which is just so nice to see. When an actor just really loves what they're doing, that's a really nice thing to watch. He's good in the emotional moments. He's good in the action scenes. He is perfectly adequate for all that he is asked to do as Bond. My problem that I ran into is I felt that he was, because of all of that, I felt like he was indistinct as Bond. When we switched from Roger Moore to Timothy Dalton, it felt like, I mean, from the minute Timothy Dalton came on screen in that great opening where, you know, they're climbing the rocks and then he parachutes onto that yacht, I mean, that was just a revelation. It was like, whoa, here's the new guy, and watch out, because he's dangerous and he's awesome, and he's totally about to get it on with this model in the French Riviera. But there is something about Pierce Brosnan's portrayal, and it might be because this is a movie that, I felt like the stakes were so high that they were kind of playing it safe. That there's nothing about this Bond that is too much one way or the other of anything. You know, he looks perfect. He is good in everything he is asked to do. But I felt like there wasn't any really distinguishing characteristic about this Bond that made me amazed the way I was amazed with Timothy Dalton's entrance when we first saw him. So that kind of colored my appreciation of this movie again. And it's a really hard thing to say, because I can't say anything bad about Pierce Brosnan. There's nothing bad about his performance at all. He's very good. But I think what I'm missing is that next thing beyond good, which was to find a surprise in his performance. And I didn't find any surprises in his performance.
Or like a trademark.
Yeah, yeah. And now the good thing is we've got three more to go. And we'll get to see him evolve a little bit in this role. But I think the strengths of the movie are the movie itself, not necessarily specific to Pierce Brosnan. Pierce Brosnan is sort of a given. It's by saying that he was born to play this role, yeah, he was born to play this role. It's a given that he is James Bond in this movie, no question about it. But there is nothing beyond that that made me go, oh, wow, he was born to play this role, and what have I been missing in all these other movies until we got this guy?
I think for me, the thing that Pierce was able to bring that I don't know if anybody else was quite the way that he did, which was to portray that the sexy cavalier attitude towards life, the panache, is a veneer for the pain he hides inside. Because there is the moment where you think of Trevelyan, you know, when it's revealed that he is alive and he's Giannis. And then the moment where he's sitting on the beach and she's, you know, challenging him about why are you so cold? You know, he's your friend and you will kill him. And he's like, that's what keeps me alive.
Mm-hmm.
But that there's something about that also keeps him kind of dead.
See, there's great dialogue about that. I don't know that I felt it, though. And I'm really glad they addressed that in the movie, because it's an important character thing about Bond. And they were really wise to put lines like that in there. And I'm glad that they appeared in the movie when they did. I don't know that I felt it, though. And that's the difference. It's like I could intellectually go, oh, yeah, because that's who he is. And that's why this character is challenging him in this way. But I don't know if it was a sort of a gut thing for me.
And I felt like that was more the fault of the actress in that moment delivering those lines than it was Pierce's response. Because I felt like if he had it didn't feel like he had enough like gravitas mm-hmm. coming at him to throw it back necessarily. I don't know if that makes sense, but there just seemed to be something that wasn't quite clicking there for them to really have
blame
that
him.
Moment.
No, here's right. I said that as a joke, but it's like, you know, an hour before we saw him like hit the button to release the bottle of Bollinger in his Aston Martin. And it's like, yeah, he's got a rough life. He's also got chilled Bollinger in his Aston Martin.
That's true. Know? I mean, that is true.
And it's a very different thing. You know, fortunately on this show, unlike Mission Log, we get to jump the timeline. And when we jump the timeline here, we get to see the reinvention of Bond with Daniel Craig. You know, we're still in, for lack of a better word, with Pierce Brosnan, we're still sort of in prime James Bond timeline, where even though we play loosey-goosey with the actual amount of time that has elapsed, we're still saying that this is the same Bond. The person who has mm-hmm. changed is M, not Bond. So even though, yeah, this is not the same guy who was on a mission in 1962, it's still the same Bond in sort of a vaguely, you know, spiritually connected Bond in that respect. It's only when we get to Craig that we say, okay, we're going to wipe the slate clean, restart, and re-justify everything that makes James Bond who he is and everything that is in his world, which I think was a brilliant thing to do, and probably the right decision to wait and do that with Craig rather than trying to do it with Pierce Brosnan.
The one thing that I also feel like that Pierce brings to the role is the fact that I felt like the serious and the silly, as I could put it, flows effortlessly
yes.
through him.
Mm-hmm.
So he can do both sides of the Bond. So he can be the Connery and the Moore right. all at the same time. And it doesn't seem incongruous coming from him. Like when he's just goofing off and playing in Q's office,
yeah.
you know, you can tell he's just being obnoxious to be obnoxious to Q.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he likes it. It's fun.
Like, don't
you know,
touch that. That's my sandwich.
Yeah. He just enjoys being obnoxious around Q because it's like he's that, you know, 12-year-old boy in Wonderland with all the toys there, and he just likes touching things because he knows
right.
it annoys Q,
right.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing that I feel like, again, just kind of what his signature is that Pierce had that ability to do both of those sides of Bond in a way that you just accept, like you said, John, it's kind of effortless. And maybe that comes off as a detriment in some ways because you're not thinking about, oh man, he really had to go deep there and like really no, it just he
yeah.
just is
yeah.
the character. And I think, you know, more than any other of the Bonds, I think it at least in this first film of his, he's able to completely pull together what it means to be Bond.
Yeah.
Effortlessly, you know, and so that's a real testament to him. I wanted to ask you guys real quick before we leave Pierce and everything, what did you think about them talking about story-wise him as Bond, you know, and making him somebody who is kind of relevant in the age of, you know, numbers.
Well, I mean, that was kind of their first stab at it in this, is to try to decide who is Bond now compared to the guy that we've seen for 30 plus years before. And like I said, we don't get to a true reinvention until we reintroduce Bond with Casino Royale with Daniel Craig. So this is their first stab at trying to justify why this guy is here and why his life is a bit incongruous with the way that the world has changed. And I think they did that in a very adequate, very clever way. I mean, they did it with, first of all, by having the psychologist with him in that opening scene, by his interaction with M. But then you ground it back to that old Bond by having Q there. So they did a nice job, I think, of having a foot in the old world and a foot in the new with this Bond. And actually reinforce that by having the prologue and the action of the movie take place 9 years apart. We start in the Soviet Union, and the story takes place in the post-fall of the Soviet Union with the world being in disarray. And it was this good kind of metaphor for what's going on with Bond justifying his existence there as well.
And I'll add to what you said, John, and say I think that they did a great balance of, like you're saying, having one foot in the previous Bond and one foot in, you know, more modern era reality, because that was what really captured me, was his conversation in the office with M. Not only do I love Judi Dench, mm-hmm. she is a powerful actress, but I felt like the writers were intentionally saying, you know, maybe in the past we've kind of been a little chauvinistic and could be a little bit more feminist. Mm-hmm. Not in a bad way, just more equal treatment. And I like that M says, you know, maybe in the past you've been able to wink an eye at people and get whatever you want, but that's not how I do things.
Yeah.
I am your boss, and you can't smooze me into doing whatever you want. I'm your boss. And I don't have any qualms about sending you in a place where I know you're probably going to die, because we've got to get a job done. I don't want you to die, but I know that sometimes that's got to happen. Yeah. And I just felt like that was perfect for saying, you know, I could be either a man or a woman in this role. I'm just here to get a job done.
Yeah, that was something that I thought overall the movie does a very good job of talking about, you know, and this is something the Craig movies also do too, which is, you know, the importance of human intelligence, you know, and that, you know, just crunching numbers, you know, on a spreadsheet, you can get things wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting, you know, that Bond is proven right in the end. You know, his instincts, his the fact that he's been doing this for so long, it means something, you know. And it was that's what makes it so interesting, that the conversation that he has with M, and that in the end, you know, these characters kind of need each other, and she's going to help him come into the, you know, the 21st century, basically the 20th century, the end of it. He's going to help her with realizing that just because it's new doesn't mean it's better,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's kind of a great conversation to have happening in the film. And talking of the new M, you know, and Judi Dench, Dame Judi Dench, that is.
Mm.
What I thought was most fascinating is watching the few extras that there were on. There aren't a lot of great extras, unfortunately. But one of the main things that I pulled from that was the idea from the writers and everything that this M is absolutely not really a big fan of the 00 section in the first place, which I thought was fascinating, because that is something that M will fight against later on in the later Bond films, and especially with the Craig movies, where she's trying to justify their existence. But here, she's absolutely not 100% sold that they're necessary anymore. So I thought that was really fascinating for her character to be that foil for Bond, and Bond kind of having to be the person as a 00 that justifies the fact that they need to exist. I thought, I love the relationship they have and everything, and I felt like she's just the perfect casting. And it's very funny because when you watch the extras, she's so much different than the M character, who's, you know, just like so confident in everything she does. And I love that Judi Dench was a huge Bond fan and wanted to do this. I mean, to me, that just speaks volumes.
And is so good at being so tough on camera. And I love that then we get her back again with the Craig era. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's just incredible in everything to me. But I like too, Matt, like your point that sometimes you need instinct versus numbers. That moment when she says, well, our analysts say blah. And he goes, and how many times have your analysts been right? You know? He's got a point. I mean, he has the, you know, in the reality experience of things and has been on so many missions, and she hasn't. She has her analysts.
This was such a big deal when she got cast as M. I mean, second only to being a big deal that Pierce Brosnan got cast as Bond, because that was inevitable. But Judi Dench casting a woman in the role of M was a massive thing in 1995. And now, you know, we kind of look back on that and we go, well, of course. I mean, Judi Dench was born to play the role of M, the way that we look at Pierce Brosnan being born to play the role of Bond. She's so good. And it was wise of the filmmakers to start sneaking in these little bits of reinvention for Bond. To try to justify who he is, because this is a different era from 1962 James Bond. It's not the boys' club anymore. It's not just, you know, guys out there with guns saving the world. There are other concerns to have, and she is the absolute perfect foil for that. And I'm so glad that we have gotten as much of Judi Dench in that role as we have.
Yeah, that's the thing I love, too, is that the fact that she continued on. You know, I love that that's the one thing they kept from the old Bond films when they moved to Craig. Because she is so good in the role, and I think the small amount of screen time that she does have here, she really cements herself as this character. Like, you never question who she is and her authority. She just plays it so effortlessly, a lot like Pierce does, honestly. They both seem kind of born to play these type of roles, and I absolutely adore when he's talking to Tanner, and Tanner's like, oh, so the evil queen of numbers won't play you, let you play your hunch, and you just see Bond's face like, she's right behind you, dude. She's right behind you. And then, of course, he turns around and he's like, oh, yeah. And she just brushes it off like, yeah, whatever. You know, she doesn't care because she's very confident in who she is and what she believes to be the right thing to do. And so, you know, and what was also fascinating, again, is just watching her and Bond kind of find a working relationship here so that, you know, she sees his value, he sees her value, and I feel like, you know, as the movie ends, it's one of the relationships I'm most excited about seeing play out in the next Bond, to see where this goes, because obviously this one started off a little antagonistic. But by the end, that I think they've both kind of proven their worth as their characters, and so that's really fascinating to me. And also, I think, you know, we have like three different villains in this movie, which any good Bond movie, I feel like, has multiple layers of villains. And I have to say, I think, I'll just spoil it right up front, I think Sean Bean as Alec Trevelyan is one of Bond's best villains, just because the way that they create all of this history with the character of Bond, so it's personal and it's business at the same time, I mean, it's just a villain you end up caring about what happens to him and what his motivations are and all of that. I feel like they've written themselves one of the very best villains they've ever come up with, honestly.
I agree. I think that this villain in particular also has that rich history of his upbringing, that apparently he came from all of this, you know, upheaval in Russia. And then it seems like he took that anger with him and decided to infiltrate MI6 and continue then being sort of a double agent for a while, you know, playing both sides. And then ultimately try to overthrow them and go back to his roots. That is just masterful. I mean, because it takes such premeditation. I mean, he spent most of his life being this horrible, angry person, and then also convinces Bond that they have this deep-rooted friendship and completely betrays him, or rather Bond thinks he's been betrayed. They were never really friends. Is a terrible feeling for Bond to have. And I could clearly see the shock on Brosnan's face portrayed so well in that revealing moment. I think that this is, I agree absolutely with you, Matt, one of the strongest villains we've ever had.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to outdo him. You know, we talked about what is the big plot here, the existential threat in the movie and this post-Soviet era, weapons on the loose and the sort of motivated factions to shake up the world. But that's one thing. It's another thing when you make it also personal. And they found a way to have balance to both of those influences here for our bad guys in this. Fast forwarding again to the Craig era, I love the fact that they are able to rebuild and re-justify a character like Blofeld and give him a personal reason to be there. But then going back and watching this, it's like, oh, well, they did just as well, if not better, with Sean Bean as Alec Trevelyan to give him a personal tie to Bond and also give him a personal and political motivation for what he's doing.
And then that horrible burn on his face.
Oh, yeah. You got to have a scarred Bond villain. Come on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing I thought was really interesting, too, like you were talking about, John, they've created this historical significance to the character through. And what I love is that it is a relic of the Cold War. It is a relic of what happened at the very end of World War II, where, you know, England, not as Bond says, not one of our finer moments, sells out the Cossacks and gives them back to Stalin, and they're all promptly shot. You know, so not one of the finer moments in history. So what I really like here is the way that they've been able to kind of ground the entire thing in history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that makes this really a strong Bond movie as well, because, yes, it's very much tied to the time period that it's in, but it's also one of its biggest strengths because of that, because it makes this story relevant any every time you watch it, because it has its time period and it uses it well. And so the character of Trevelyan is one that it holds to the past, but it's also using the present there with everything that's going on and creating this crime syndicate where, you know, crime syndicates are going to become a bigger and bigger deal throughout the world. And obviously the fall of a regime like the Soviet Union into kind of this despotic, capitalism that you could call it in some ways. And just all of that, I think, is really smart. But the character himself, I mean, Sean Bean is great. He's so good in the role. And he relishes the role that he has. And he plays it with such fervor and just kind of animosity towards Bond and the British and why he's taking the revenge out on them. Basically trying to do to them what, you know, was done to his people. And it just, it's so, I don't know, it's so good. Like, I don't have any more words for how good it is. It really is. If I'm ranking Bond villains, I'm hard pressed not to say that this is the best Bond villain. Like, I can't really think of another one that has this much meaning to the character of Bond and feels so organic to the story that they've created. Like, it doesn't, there's nothing about it that feels cheap or silly or any of that kind of stuff. It just, I don't know, it's a really good job with the writers here. It's probably the best thing that they did in this movie.
And so, I'll add to what you said, Matt, that I feel like, well, I know in the past some of the plots and villains have been a lot more fantastical, and this is so grounded and realistic and based in history. It feels more like a dramatic interpretation of actual history than it does of, you know, just a fantasy.
Right. And then, I mean, when they kind of get a little bit fantastical with an EMP's base weapon, you know, you still, it still doesn't feel, I mean, it feels like the perfect Bond villain motivation and weapon and everything like that. It doesn't feel so removed that I get pulled out like a Moonraker.
Right. Like it's that, entirely, you know, possible in that time to have an electromagnetic weapon.
Well, I'm wondering then what we all think of Xenia Onatopp.
Well, that name.
What I love is the way that she's described. I was looking at some information on Wikipedia. They describe her as a Georgian lust murderer.
Like that's
a nice way to
like
say
this
it.
It's a thing, you know. It's just
a thing, apparently. Lust murderer. I don't even want to like Google that. So
don't go to Webster for lust.
Pretty sure
murderer.
I met one online at one point.
Please.
I don't know.
Oh, jeez.
It was so odd that they went that route though with this villain. I mean, she's a great female villain, I'm not gonna lie, and it was super creepy, but it doesn't it just always make you feel a little icky?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that she's like, she is a sadist, you know.
Yeah, that's her thing.
Yeah, she enjoys killing people, and she gets off on it, you know, like. And I think maybe they just do it so well, because I'm with you, Christy, I do find it icky. And I think that's what your response is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. This is, I mean, more than her being any kind of sexy, I just find her icky. And I think maybe that's what they're going for. And if that is what they're going for, they nail it.
And she's an incredible actress, period. I mean, as we all know, she goes on to be Jean Grey in X-Men.
She was having a very busy 90s.
Yeah. but she is perfect at pulling off super creepy in this role. I love introducing her in the car chase. I wrote, she's my kind of girl. She drives a red Ferrari. So we'd be best friends until the killing started, and then we can't be friends anymore. And I think that it's also along with the psychological side of the story, talking about, you know, mental issues, that there are actual people that have this issue that, you know, like a serial killer can have this problem where that's something that they enjoy, and like that their mind is so messed up that that's where their mind goes. And so that's why you find her so terrifying, because you think, who could possibly think that way? And that, you know, in the first scene with her and this man on the yacht, you're thinking, oh, well, she's probably just a hooker. And then you go, oh, that's weird.
Yes. Xenia over the top. She was, I mean, honestly, if she had gone just one step further, just 1 ounce more crazy, we could have chalked this up to some terrible decisions. But this was the right combination of actor and writer and director and the right movie to make you intrigued by this character and not just think, okay, they've gone a step too far. This is sort of the things that I liked about Christopher Walken's performance in A View to a Kill, which is not a good movie by any stretch of the imagination, is that you can watch Christopher Walken and go like, yeah, he can portray a character who is a psychopath, who is just not all there. And you can watch Famke Janssen in this and go, yeah, she's a psychopath, but she's also gorgeous. So she can kind of get wherever she wants to go and do whatever she wants to do and probably get away with a lot of it. And it is creepy to watch her get off on the murdering and the broken lives that she leaves behind.
I mean, mowing people down with machine guns.
Yes, yes. Which, you know, to be honest, between her and General Urumov both just shooting people left and right, the number of times they have Bond right in front of them and don't pull the trigger. Come on, guys. Come on. Mm-hmm. You're making the number one mistake here of Bond bad guys, which is not just shooting Bond. Because you.
Well, she fell for the touch.
She did. She did. She did. But there.
And then in the pool.
Yeah.
I mean, she wanted her she peace did, she before did. He died.
Right.
But,
right?
She, you know? I mean,
and he said no.
She's great. And in any less skilled hands, it would have just been comical. But she's really good.
I mean, it gives Bond the perfect opportunity to make the safe mm-hmm. sex mm-hmm. joke.
Right.
So it's that which works perfectly still, honestly.
And his whole thing with liking a woman with authority and then her name is on a top.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay.
I love when he's in M's office and he is slightly embarrassed by saying her name in front of her.
Right.
That's great. Like, it's such a, it's a great, Pierce choosing that portrayal of, like, trying to be diplomatic and saying her name. It's almost like, I'm sorry she's named this. I apologize. I know this isn't proper for me to be saying in front of you. It's
or maybe only saying her first name could have been another choice.
Yeah, maybe. Xenia. Maybe, yeah. What did we think of the general? Because this is the one part of the movie I kind of almost... he just feels like the stooge almost that just gets played by everybody. He's just being used... and honestly, I don't know. To me, he wasn't super interesting or anything. He's just kind of a character that they need to do other things.
I mean, he looks the part.
Bingo.
Yeah, and it was hilarious when he goes into the room with this meeting of all these leaders and says, you know, that he's got evidence to pin it on these people. And the guy says, well, except for, you know, there were two people that escaped. And he goes, oh, I thought there was only... one.
Yeah,
and then you just go, oh, you fool.
Yeah, you need him there, and it's good that they chose somebody who is so distinctive looking, and can kind of chew the scenery a little bit, so he isn't just another guy, so he's not just another bad guy, because he could get overshadowed very easily by Sean Bean or by Famke Janssen. But he holds his own, you know. It's not the most complex role, but it's fun to see him have one up on others around him, and then it's finally fun to see him get his in the end.
But does Famke really need him?
I would say no. I would say no.
She could have just kicked him out of the helicopter.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
Yeah, the only reason she needs him is to get into that End of Severn Eye.
Yeah, right.
Right, and get the golden eye, and then she can leave.
They've gotten into it, and they got the key. She could have just killed him.
And that would have been perfectly within
character. She could have squished him.
For her. Yeah,
it would have been. I mean, that actually would have been perfect. I'm going to write Martin Campbell. Can we re-edit the movie? Okay. What's kind of cool about this movie is that Bond has a bunch of new friends. And I got to say, you know, anytime you put Robbie Coltrane into a movie, he's fantastic. And again, they create a character that has this history with Bond. And so I love Valentine. I really like him in this movie. I enjoy going to his lair and having Minnie Driver, who we know can actually sing, pretend like she can't sing.
So off-key.
As his girlfriend, or his mistress, excuse me. Like, the whole thing, I felt like this movie, they did a really good job of writing and just creating characters in the world which Bond inhabits and coming up with things that feel organic and fun. And Robbie Coltrane's character was definitely... a very fun part of the movie for me, and I perfect casting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for a movie with so many Russians in the story, very few actual Russians doing anything in this movie, except I think some of the soldier extras, like in the St. Petersburg scenes, were actually Russians. But Robbie Coltrane, does a very good job portraying this gangster. And for what would have otherwise just been kind of a two-dimensional role as a heavy, he actually gave it some life. And it's nice to see him and Bond done. I love the cut in that scene. He's plugged the couch a couple more times. Bond jumps into explaining their gambit. And then the very next cut is them having this drink together in his office. It's a really nicely crafted sequence.
It was like he was doing a bit to look tough in front of his team, and then actually they're buddies and it's fine.
Well, and the fact that he's the one who gave him the limp, you know, because he shot him in the leg was just, I mean, it is kind of like classic Bond and the sense of, too, like, that's how you create a relationship between two guys. Like, yeah, I shot him. We're friends.
Right. With women, it does not work that way.
By shooting him in the leg, right? Yeah. So, and I have to say, I love that, you know, I didn't feel like he was a good villain in The Living Daylights. But I do like Jodan Baker back here as Jack Wade, the CIA officer, who's basically the Felix Leiter of this film. Mm-hmm. And he's so effortless. And we keep saying that, but I feel like he is perfectly effortless in his role as the CIA operative who it seems a little world weary. You know, it seems like he's been at this a long time. But the relationship that him and Pierce end up having, it's like they're brothers from another mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really funny. And his joke about, Bond, do you do any gardening after looking at his tattoo? It's just perfect. I mean, he's great in this movie.
Yeah, I especially love when he seems to, every time when he appears, say things like, and you know, of course, the CIA was not here.
Yes.
This didn't happen. Yeah. You didn't see anything.
Yeah, he's totally perfect. And it is one of those where, like I said, in Living Daylights, he's over the top in the wrong way. And there is every opportunity to make this character the wrong character, like the bad Felix Leiter, or God forbid, like a J.W. Pepper, just a sort of bigger-than-life presence on screen who takes you out of the movie. But he's dead on. And I loved rewatching some of the scenes they have together, just their physicality. I don't know if you watched the, there's an outtake of them riding around St. Petersburg in that little tiny, tiny car. And it's just him doing this monologue and Bond has kind of had it up to here with him. But all those two together, their physicality was great. Little moments like Bond tossing him the keys to the BMW, and he catches him with his hat and then hops in the car and does this donut to just like all those moments just to give it some life. He's really terrific in that.
This movie found, for the most part, I would there are a couple of times when the line is a bit of a groaner, but I think for the most part they found a way to have the humor and the seriousness of Bond all together. And Jack Wade was definitely a character that added some fun levity and just some lightness to it without taking away from anything that was happening. Like they never cut in a scene of him or had a joke where it ended up ruining what should have been a, you know, heavy scene. You know, I really enjoyed him. And we do have a new Moneypenny, Samantha Bond. I love that that's her last name.
Right, it's perfect.
Who will be Moneypenny throughout the entire Brosnan run. You know, she just seems to kind of pick up where Lois Maxwell left off.
She is so sassy. I agree with you.
Yeah, like she, I don't know. I feel like they wanted to, and they at least worked hard on trying to create a relationship that felt reminiscent of that. And the way that she kind of gives it back to Bond, I really enjoy. About where she challenges him, this could be considered sexual harassment.
Or when she says, like, one day you're going to have to make good on your promises.
Yeah. So I just really enjoy
I think their dialogue is good, but I'm actually going to disagree to the point that I think that this is one of the misfires in the movie, and it probably has something to do again with the anticipation around her. So go back to 1995, early 95, and all these casting announcements and the behind-the-scenes stuff starting to leak about this movie. So much anticipation about Pierce Brosnan, so much attention on Judi Dench, and whoa, we've got a new Moneypenny. For the first time, we have this brand new money, and just, not the very first time, because we did have a new Moneypenny with Dalton, but they made a big deal out of Samantha Bond being Moneypenny, and I thought there would have been more to her than a couple of good lines of dialogue in there. I don't know what that thing would have been. I don't know what would have improved that for me. But it didn't quite fire for me. And honestly, I don't remember enough about her in the three movies to come to know if I'm in for something better when we get there. But hey, we got three more episodes of this to do, so I guess I'll find out.
Mm-hmm. No, I can understand what you're saying, John, because it does feel a little bit reminiscent of the Dalton films in the sense that we don't get a lot of Moneypenny. You know, but when I do think back to a lot of the Connery movies, we don't get her a lot there either. So I don't know if maybe we as fans just made more of Moneypenny in our minds after all those years. And we just expected more. And then, but I am interested because, it's been a while since I've seen the Brosnan films. So I'm interested really to see where this goes and how they continue on with the character. But I do really feel like that the way in which she kind of accepts Bond for who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows him, and I kind of liked that they have this this sexual chemistry that just always goes unfulfilled between them, and that's okay, and it was almost it almost seemed like a good definition of a healthy male female relationship that doesn't have to have sex, but there's still that sexiness there. I don't know. It especially for the 90s, it seemed like they found a nice balance that they're both accepting of what this is and what it's not going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in the end too, they're kind of like, there seemed to be a respect between them. This is their thing and that's okay. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm explaining myself at all, but let's get into talking because our actual Bond woman for the film. And I thought it was interesting that she is a Bond woman who gets a lot to do in this story. And it's not about the action, but she has so much to do with the plot of the movie. And she's very active, but she doesn't have to sacrifice any of her femininity to be active. And I thought that was really nice. It made for, I thought, a standout Bond female role when we look at the long history as we have with these films.
I agree. I think that it's definitely a stark contrast to that scene I remember of Tiffany Case with the bikini and the machine gun that just looked ridiculous and a little sexist. She's a woman. They wear skimpy clothes and they're not good with guns. Whereas I think that Isabella in this role is really stands on her own. And like you said, Matt, she can still be feminine, but she knows coding and computers and, maybe not quite as good as Boris. I'm going to get to later. But she's got some knowledge and she's not just a pretty face. And then she goes through this really traumatic experience. You don't blame her at all for being a little torn up about it, with her whole base exploding and then having to walk through the snow to wherever, and then gets hooked up with Bond. She really seems great at keeping her distance and knowing how to get what she needs but also still having those moments of vulnerability as well, where she doesn't always know what to do.
I like her so much. She's definitely in the top of my Bond women list somewhere, maybe not in position number one, but somewhere toward the top of my favorite Bond women. Maybe it's just the whole Eastern European thing. I don't know. But I think Isabel Scorupco is stunningly beautiful. And just there's something about her character that, like, it's almost comical what she has to go through to get out of the situation that she's in at the base. You know, first she just narrowly avoids getting shot by Xenia. And then as that place is crashing down around her, gets out of there. She finds herself strapped into the helicopter with Bond. You know, everything that could possibly go wrong for her goes wrong on this journey. But she still has this great strength. She still has something to contribute. She's not just a damsel in distress by any means. I think she is super cool. So very glad to see her. And glad to see her as, of the two strong women in this movie, glad to see her as a counterpoint to the psychopath Xenia on a top.
But it is funny how they introduce her with that whole joke with Boris, that you think maybe it's going to be like Bond women of the past, where he goes, they're right in front of you and you can use them to open large doors.
Yep.
One of the things that I liked about her too is that we don't pretend like she has to be good at everything.
Right.
Like the fact that, you know, she's kind of screaming at what's happening to her, I thought created the nice reality of who she is. She is just an analyst, you know, who is working on computers all day. And like her life has nothing to do with this spy life. You know, so I felt like they had a really nice balance of who she is and what she's been through and what she's been through in the film, what she goes through. And, you know, by the end, when Bond's like, can you use this? She takes the gun and like you can tell she's had some training. But that's not who she is, you know, like she's not somebody who's necessarily comfortable with it, but she can do it. Like they just made her such a capable person and a well-rounded person, but she didn't have to be everything in the movie. Like she could be frail at certain points and that's okay. But you know what? So is Bond at certain points in this movie, you know, and they brought that out in each other and so I liked the relationship they had and everything. It felt realistic for two people who have kind of been thrown into this position together. And she sort of understands kind of who he is. And, you know, it's not like it's supposed to be more, you know, like, I don't know. Again, it just felt like kind of an adult connection and relationship with each other, which was really nice. And I think she does a good job. There are some points where I wanted a little bit more from her, I think, emotionally, but for the most part, I think she delivers the character really well. And so we didn't talk about Boris and I when we were talking about our villains.
Alan Cumming.
But, you know, I will say this. I think Alan Cumming plays the role just to the hilt. You know, I think he kind of portrayed the geeky, nerdy, sexually repressed
programmer
a-hole that he is perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is priceless. As you said, Matt, before, I'm invincible. He's got a little bit of an ego on him. Because he is this brilliant programmer, he just thinks that he is better than everyone, he can do anything, and that he is going to crack all of your codes, and the American babies are going to cry. And it really, that this and some other movies of this time about the technology really made me want to be a like code master, because you're like, oh, what's a spike? That sounds fun. And man, he's hacking everybody's databases. But then you feel so bad for her that she really thought that they were friends. And then that reveal that he's joined Famke Janssen and, you know, their whole team was great. And then the whole moment with her managing to beat his code for once and cause everything to blow up in his face, literally, was hilarious.
Yes. All of the above. I mean, it's another one of those characters where, pushed a little bit more, he would have just come across as a stereotype, a little unbelievable. But, I mean, come on, it's Alan Cumming. And he's so good, and he gives life and believability to what on paper would have just been sort of like, okay, yeah, he's nerdy, he's sexually repressed, he's a little over the top, but we actually get a sense for who he is instead of just what he does. He's pretty great. In a movie with... For any faults that I could find with this movie, the casting is definitely not one of the faults in this movie.
Yeah. No. And they all work so well together for being a lot of big names in one movie. Because I think you run the danger sometimes of they try to add so many A-listers in one movie, you're going, okay, this is just going to be a who's who and not an actual great film. Whereas this really had a basis, great story, and then brought in good people.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of, you know, this is first time Bond's been back, you know, 6 years. What did you guys think of the action of this movie? Because that's always a big part of James Bond movies. And of course, a lot of people, the action they felt like was lackluster in A License to Kill. I've heard that from a lot of people. So what did you guys think about Bond's big return here in GoldenEye with these action set pieces?
Yeah, I mean, they don't skimp on anything. No. If you find fault with anything, it's just that, yeah, so in the 23 years since that movie has been made, there are certain effects, techniques that have been improved. I love all the miniature work. I loved watching the behind-the-scenes stuff and everything that Derek Mettings did for this. And they're showing these, you know, remote-controlled MiG fighters that they built, remote-controlled helicopters, and the Severnaya set, all that exterior. It is just an incredible-looking model. So they did a great job with that. Even from the beginning, just the car chase is shot in a really thrilling, exciting way that you feel like, yes, you too could go right over the edge of that mountain with them. The opening bungee jump off the dam is so good. It is reminiscent back to that, you know, Spy Who Loved Me, the going right off the edge of the cliff with the skis. I will find one fault with that, though. It leads right into another great action sequence with Bond meeting Alec and them taking down the chemical weapons base. However, I watched that scene probably four times, trying to calculate in my head, like, okay, Bond starts at the top of this dam way up in the mountains. He jumps off, and at 70 stories, so 700 feet down, he then penetrates further into the depths of this base.
Yes.
But when he comes out of the base, he's on top of a mountain in the snow. And I'm trying to remember where the scene is where he takes the express elevator somewhere back up to the top of another mountain to then escape in an airplane. Something in there doesn't add up. But.
That's absolutely 100% true.
But other than that, they build tension really effectively. Really, every scene that has any action in it, they build tension really effectively. And man, that tank chase in St. Petersburg is just so good. And what a set piece, because they shot some of it there, and then they built a huge section of St. Petersburg Street at their studio to get the stuff that they couldn't shoot on location. It's remarkable looking.
And I love the joke that even though they have all these great action scenes with vehicles, that she goes, "You're always in trouble in a vehicle. I'm not getting in another one with you. But I do agree. I think that the tension is built really well in all of the action scenes. I especially love the tank chase so much better than a boat chase, let me just add. And the train scenes later were just amazing as well. And I felt like that whole thing with them escaping through the floor, and she's literally still looking up information as he's counting down, and he's like, okay, we really have to go now.
Yes. Yes. Love it.
One of the things that I felt like with the action is it felt like Bond, but it also felt, again, like something that could happen for the most part. I mean, catching up to the airplane,
okay,
obviously
that.
We know that's you know,
yeah
that's yeah. Probably not going to happen.
A little too implausible.
But the rest of the, I mean, the rest of the stuff that happens in the movie just feels so real, you know? And yeah, that tank chase is just, I'm with you. It's a standout Bond moment when he's just crashing through everything. And then, of course, when he fixes his tie is great. And so it felt so, again, I feel like I keep saying this with this movie, but so much of it feels very organic to what's happening. And the story plot structure all flows very well together for why certain characters are in certain places, why certain things are happening. And I love it. And I think, you know, one of the beauties of the action is the way that they use the sets and the places that they are, especially within a previously Cold War Russia, where you're in that statue.
Gorgeous.
A graveyard,
yeah.
Which just is gorgeous. You know, all of this stuff, I feel like they've done such a fantastic job of thinking through all of these elements, and the production and the set design and all this stuff is working together perfectly with the action to create a film that just has such an identity. It knows what it's trying to do and what it's trying to be, and it's fantastic. So I think the only thing that doesn't really fit in this movie.
Hate it like poison.
Okay, tell me, are you meaning the opening song or all of the
music? No, not the opening song. We'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
But just the score, for the most part, except for the tank chase, which they replaced for the film, where they added in like the Bond theme and everything, and that sounds like a normal Bond score. But like, say when they're doing the car chase at the beginning with Bond and Onatopp,
yeah,
it's just this weird, like, it's like Lady Hawk bad, kind of like techno weird. I don't know what's happening. Why are you doing this?
Yeah, when it's not the Bond theme, everything else score wise was bad. It felt a little outdated. It felt misplaced. I agree with you, Matt.
It's terrible. It's really horrendous. And even from the opening with the gun barrel logo, I just thought, okay, I know you. The Bond opening gets a little bit of a redress from Bond actor to Bond actor or era to era. This was not a good redress of that opening sequence. And there were moments in the film, like the scene in the statue graveyard of the old Soviet statues, and Bond and Alec are re-meeting for the first time here. And as I'm watching that scene, there's some music playing there, and I had to stop for a moment and say, now, is that something that I'm just hearing outside of my headphones? Because whatever I'm hearing does not fit this scene. When I started playing again, I was like, yes, somebody ruined this scene by putting some music in there that is just terrible, just so bad. It is truly one of the worst Bond soundtracks of all time.
There are some moments where there's just the kind of the dark Bond theme where it's like dun 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 dun, and it's done with this kind of in between orchestral and techno, but I don't know what it is, but it works really well in certain places. Like there's some things that they choose to do that are good. I thought the romantic music was good when like Bond is on the beach and he's talking to Natalia. That music is good, but it's this weird action music that just wow. Like, it's just, I don't know what they're thinking, and it's just awful. So let's stop talking about it, because let's get to something that was amazing, is when Bono and The Edge get together with Tina Turner to create a Bond song. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I think it's good. I think it's good.
I think it's good. Wait.
See, here's the thing. Like, overall, I think this movie plays it safe in a lot of places. So, like, there is nothing wrong with Tina Turner. There's nothing wrong with bringing in Bono and The Edge to dress that up, okay? But I felt like it was sort of like in License to Kill. So it was sort of like a Bond theme by the numbers. This is much better, much, much better than License to Kill for the opening theme. But this is not one of those songs that I want to throw into my playlist from when I'm driving. I want to hear Live and Let Die. I want to hear Thunderball. I want to hear I want to hear A View to a Kill. I want to hear, you know, because those are just so distinctive to me. There's nothing wrong with this song. This is not particularly distinctive to me. And I say that as a fan of Tina Turner and obviously a fan of the Bond films. So you guys can keep this one. That is fine by me. You add this to your playlist. It's not going to be in mine. Okay, good.
Oh, good. It's on my playlist.
Yeah.
Because you're wrong.
I'm like, it's I'm going to so play good. Devil's Advocate, and Matt and I will be over here Thanks. Enjoying it, because I really thought okay. it was distinctive with that opening bum, bum, bum. You know, that comes to mind immediately for me. And the way that she mm-hmm. sings the word Goldeneye really sure, yeah. sticks out to me.
Because she's Tina Turner. She's awesome.
I think that it.
I feel like she's just like biting into every part of the song. Like she's just chewing it up and like spitting it back out at you. Like there's something about the song. But I also do feel like it's the visuals. Honestly, I feel like this may be the first great Bond opening visual yeah. sequence. Like, it is amazing. Like, because the story that they're actually telling about the kind of like the fall of the, you know, Soviet Union through it all, and it's everything you want from the Bond visual opening. So it fits with the song. It's sexy, it's provocative, it's everything you want. And so to me, I think that's one of the things that makes the song really work. But I will play Devil's Advocate. I think, you know, this is a song that I love. It's on my playlist. I love it when it comes on. There's something about it that just kind of like, there's like a sultriness to it. Like in it, I think that's just the Tina Turner yeah. coming out, you know. But I felt like, when you think of people that should sing a Bond song, you know, Tina Turner was one of those people, and they've got her finally. And I felt like, to me, it just, yeah, it hums.
I do great. Agree with you. The opening credits sequence is awesome. I think it's one of the cooler ones, because I just love all that Soviet imagery, and they made it sexy, and they made it weird. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, the gun it's popping out weird. Of her mouth.
That was another one I rewound. Like, what's, huh? Really? Okay. but, you know, just for you two, I'm going to add it back to my playlist, and we'll see if it grows on me.
Yeah.
But right now, yeah, it didn't grow on me.
So speaking of playlists, I will tell you, my number one Bond song has become Skyfall by Adele.
Yeah.
It is so powerful.
Yeah, it's hard to beat Skyfall. But to me, and I will be honest, I think that next to Skyfall, this may be like number two or three for me. Like,
it'd be three for me after Live and Let Die.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I think, there's something about this song I really like. And I think part of it, you nailed it, Christy. I just, the way it begins, where it's just bum, 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 bum. The beat that Bono and The Edge created for this song, I don't know, there's something about it. So anyway, we could honestly keep talking about this movie, but we don't have the time because John has got to scoot soon because he's got some mission log stuff to attend to. So I wanted to ask you guys, we've talked through so much of this movie. where do you come down with GoldenEye? Was it the golden reinvention for Bond, or was it just stuck somewhere in an old Soviet dumping site for, you know?
So, well, I tell you what, I struggled with this one a little bit because as we have been doing this series of podcasts, I found movies that I liked better than I thought I did. And not by huge leaps, but like Man with the Golden Gun surprised me that I liked it better now than I thought I did. Live and Let Die, I was surprised that I did not like that movie as much as I thought I did. GoldenEye, there was just a tremendous amount of anticipation for me in 1995, tremendous amount of anticipation for me now watching it for our show. And at the end of the day, I have to say, like, there's no denying that this was the right movie at the right time and with the right cast. And I think if there is anything that surprised me about the cast, it's going back to our conversation about Pierce Brosnan. He's very good in the role, but there wasn't anything beyond that that jumped out at me about him in the role. I also think that this is a movie that, like I said, is kind of playing it safe. They know that there's a lot on the line. They know that they have to kind of reinvent Bond a bit for the audience and for the 90s. And now they've got this actor that they've been chasing for 10 years to get into this role. I'm glad that it took them longer to get Pierce Brosnan than they did. Because I think had it been Pierce Brosnan in 1985, it would have felt pretty different. He would have felt like a kid in this role. So there's a lot to like, but I also feel like that there are things in this movie that have not aged well. All the elements are there, but, you know, I was struggling with this and I thought, okay, where do I really land on this? Because if you'd asked me 10 or 15 years ago, I would have said, this is a 9 out of 10. And then I watched it the first time for our rewatch today and I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe I give it a 6 out of 10. But then I thought, no, it's better than that. Because they're really trying to throw everything at you. And they know that the stakes are high and they know they want to show you all the cool action that we've been missing. They know they want to correct the missteps of the last few movies. And they know they've already got a star walking into this. It's not like Timothy Dalton, who'd been a little bit under the radar, definitely a well-known actor, but not a huge megastar the way that Pierce Brosnan was. So for this, I'm going to give it a 7.5 Statues of Lenin out of 10. And I think that's fair. You might catch me on another day and I might say, yeah, I'll give this a solid 8 Statues of Lenin. Or maybe on another day, maybe it's a 6.5 Statues of Lenin. So I think it's solid. I think it's good. But I don't think it's amazing. And I feel weird saying that. Because at a time, I thought, oh, this is amazing. This is such a great Bond, and I'm so glad they reinvented this character this way. And now I watch it, and I go, you know what? I know what's coming. And maybe I'm more into the reinvention that we got in the 2000s than this reinvention. But like I said, I feel weird saying it, because I think everybody is on their A game here.
And I understand where you're coming from, John, especially being in that moment of it, like you're possibly going for, you had the rose-colored glasses of it's been a long time since we had a Bond movie. It's been 6 years. You were really waiting for something and you got this payoff and it was a huge moment. And so that may be the reason that you felt a little more love for it back then than you did on the rewatch. But I do feel a little bit differently about the portrayal of Brosnan in this role. I do think that they played it safe in a lot of ways, but I kind of felt that they needed to, because you're coming in with a completely new Bond, but after a long hiatus, I think that it's also hard for people to make that transition again to another new actor after only having Timothy Dalton for two films. going, gosh, now we're getting another guy. Because Roger Moore was around for so long and Sean Connery was around for so long. But I think that, like we said, Pierce Brosnan has this personality just in his regular life. I feel it feels so natural for him. He is this very suave person who can turn on a dime and be, you know, the Bond that gets the job done and is tough and cold as well. But can then turn and have this softer side that he has with Isabella. So I really loved him as Bond. I think that there was not much I didn't like about this movie. I think that it had a really realistic and interesting plot, and that Famke Janssen was a standout character for sure. I mean, I remember her more than I remember Alec, even though he was probably one of the best villains ever. Because she was just so creepy. And then on top of that, I knew Alan Cumming. I'm just going to throw it out there, from Spice World. As well as from Nightcrawler in X-Men, which was my favorite character in X-Men. So that was a big deal for me, getting him as Boris. So I give this a 9 out of 10 for me. trying to figure out what to use to rate with. No. I think I'll do 9 nice. Out of 10 Boris's.
Well, Boris gets a grenade pen at the end. So, I mean, a 9 out of 10 grenade pens. Because, look, if I need anything in my life, it's approximately 9 out of 10 grenade pens.
And did you ever think at some point, if there was a girl in this movie named Natasha?
You know, I was thinking through this because... And part of what I was thinking is I was listening to what you're saying, John, and I think for myself, I have to divorce this from the rest of the Brosnan movies because I know where they go, right? Yeah. I know where it ends up, but where they start here, it's such a good beginning to Bond again. And I feel like the storyline that they created is exceptional. When you think of Bond stories, the villain they've created is memorable. The characters that we got here, that the casting we got here, everything about this movie works. There really isn't anything that doesn't work except for the soundtrack. And gosh, you could have just replaced that with something else. And I mean, somebody re-edit this movie with Bond soundtrack music and you would totally work so much better. There's not really much about this movie that doesn't work. So when I kind of divorce myself from where I know that they're going to take the Brosnan run, I'm really excited because I want more of this, you know? I think, and maybe this is where I can see what you're saying, John, I think I can see the seeds, though, of what they're going to do. They're going to take this formula and they're going to do the same thing they did with Roger Moore. Which is they're just going to keep ramping it up and ramping it up until it just becomes ridiculous.
Yeah.
But here, everything works in a way that it never actually worked for a Roger Moore film for the most part. Mm. Like, I think that this works even better with that formula that they wanted there than something like, maybe this will be crazy for some people, but I think this is a better working movie than The Spy Who Loved Me.
Mm.
You know, I think when you think through the story and the characters and everything else, you know, everything here just, I feel like, falls into place. So I'm right there with you, Christy. I think I'll come between both of you and I'll say that this is 8.5 out of 10 Q sandwiches, you know, because I'm hungry right now.
Yeah, that's good. I'd take 8.5 sandwiches right now. That'd be all right.
Who wouldn't? That sandwich looked good. But this is, and I was trying to, this is something where I tried to divorce myself from the nostalgia of this one for me and just kind of try and put it into context of what we've been doing for the last year and a half now, which is talking through all these Bond films And when I think back at the history of them, I don't think Connery's introduction is this good. I don't think Dalton's introduction may be this good, but I know for sure that Roger Moore's wasn't.
Right. Yeah.
And to me, the only person who had a better Bond movie mm-hmm. as an introduction was Lazenby, because that's still my favorite mm-hmm. Bond movie. And again, that's because it's the story. And so, yeah, this is just great stuff. And I loved being able to talk about this one. I think people have been waiting for us to get to the Brosnan era. I know people are going to be excited to hear us talk about more of them. So I can't wait to dive in to Tomorrow Never Dies, because, stealth boats. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. I really want to say huge thank you to Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson for supporting the show through Patreon. And, you know, they are associate producers here on the 602 Club because of their support through Patreon. Now, Patreon is a way which you can support this network and make sure all the shows keep coming to you each and every week. It is a massive thing to put on a network of this size, and we, the hosts, can't do it alone. So go over to patreon.com/trekfm, and you can see how you can become part of the team. Support us every month. Every little bit helps. And again, that's patreon.com/trekfm. Now, Christy, thank you so much for being back. It's so much fun doing this with you. I'm so glad that you joined the Bond team. But I know you've got so much else going on these days. Where can everybody find you?
Well, you're welcome. I have been honored to be on here talking about Bond movies that I love so much with two people that have similar feelings. So you can also find me, though, on the internet. I'm on Galactic Fashion, which is a podcast I do with my friend Teresa Delgado about fashion in the realm of geekdom. So we talk about Star Wars, Star Trek, Harry Potter, Disney, everything. So we're on Twitter and Instagram at Galactic Fashion Pod. And then you can find me personally on both places as well at Bespin Bell.
And John, if anybody wants to find you and tell you how wrong you were about the opening theme song for this film, where can they find you?
They can chime in on Twitter at DVD Geeks. That's how to find me. And if you're looking for my show, that would be at Mission Log Pod. Or at the podcast network for Roddenberry. That's podcast.roddenberry.com.
Man, and you do. I mean, you really want to find John on social media. He's great. Slow Mo Gentleman is the best Twitter account ever.
Instagram.
But it's the best Instagram account.
Have a little fun
so
there.
So make
sure
you find him there. It's good stuff. You can find me on Twitter, MattRushing02, if you want to tell me how wrong I was about this movie. I'm also on Instagram under the same name. You can find me here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones, talking all about Star Trek Deep Space Nine and The Orb. I'm over on the Nerd Party Network talking about Harry Potter with Drea Kaufman on Owlpost, walking through each and every chapter of the series, one chapter at a time. I'm doing aggressive negotiations over there with John Mills, all about Star Wars all the time. It's so much fun. We can't wait for Solo. It's almost here. So make sure you're checking out Aggressive Negotiations. And last but not least, doing cinema stories with my friend Courtney as we talk about films through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now. You hear?